You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's estimated that about 330,000 of the 2.2 million people in the prison system suffer from mental illness. What happens to these inmates once they're in jail? Why do so many of them fail to receive the attention that they need to manage their symptoms? Mary Beth Pfeiffer examines what happened to six of those mentally ill inmates in her book, Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of Our Criminalized Mentally Ill. It's published by Carolyn Graff, and I'm very pleased it has brought it to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Is mental illness in prison something that you've reported on throughout your 25 years as a journalist?
Well, I periodically have come back to criminal justice issues, but really became involved with the issue of people with mental illness about 5 years ago. And my interest really was sparked by a look at suicides in our prisons here in New York State. And when I began to look at suicides, which are horrific tragedies that occur with some regularity in prisons, I found two things, basically, that they were occurring in solitary confinement units, the really harshest form of confinement in prisons. And secondly, I found that the people who were committing suicide were people with serious histories of mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, people who one would question why they had been put under such psychologically difficult circumstances.
Well, it's rough enough for anybody to be put in that kind of confinement. But they're put in there because they're acting out all the time?
Exactly. Solitary confinement units, what inmates call the box, and what prison overseers euphemistically call special housing units, are really the end of the line for people with mental illness. The people who end up in jails and prisons who are mentally ill have great difficulty just conforming with prison rules and regulations. Prison's a very tense, very difficult environment to survive in. And when they act out, they are punished for it. Essentially, they're punished for their illness.
Throughout the book, you raise the importance of control in prisons. How does that struggle for control change when you're dealing with mentally ill inmates? They know that these people are mentally ill, don't they?
Well, they certainly do. But the problem is that correction officers are not trained correctly to interact with people with mental illness. They don't know how to handle people with mental illness. And control is a very integral part of prison life, and control also makes other inmates who are not mentally ill feel better about the prison environment. There's a certain insecurity that occurs when someone starts screaming or yelling or not following orders, and there's a fear of a greater loss of control. So correction officers often respond instantaneously to that sort of thing and punitively.
Do they assume that these inmates are faking their symptoms?
There's a great deal of that. In many suicides that I studied, the prisoner had been labeled as a manipulator, a malingerer. In the case that I write about in my chapters on New York State, a 21-year-old woman who committed suicide in the box at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, she had attempted suicide before. She'd been hospitalized for it. And she had attempted suicide actually in the box. Nonetheless, after her hospitalization, she was returned to the box because the assumption was that she was doing this to get attention and to get out of the box.
Now, you started off looking at New York State's prisons, but then you wound up going to other places as well. Are they pretty much the same everywhere? Or some? I know you went to Iowa, which is sounds like... Boy, it suddenly makes a New York prison sound like heaven.
Yes, you wouldn't expect that a rural state like Iowa, with its cornfields and so on, to share a lot of the things, the conditions that we see in our New York prisons. But unfortunately, no matter where I went, to California, to juvenile facilities, Texas, to a jail, Iowa, to prisons, in fact, they're very similar from coast to coast.
You tell the stories of six mentally ill inmates in this book. Were any of them treated for their mental illness before they entered the prison system?
Well, in fact, most of them were treated for mental illness, except for my California case, a juvenile who was really kind of too young to have entered the system. But all of them had serious histories of mental illness before they went into the system. The woman I write about in Iowa, Shane, who gouged out her eyes behind bars, had been hospitalized about 25 times before she ever entered the criminal justice system. And there's a large question as to whether she should have been held accountable for her crime, whether she should have been not guilty by reason of insanity. But it's a very difficult standard to meet in our legal system, and hence she ended up in prison.
Well, you profile four men and two women. Would their sex be reflected in the nature of the crimes they committed?
I think that...
Does the mental illness make them all potentially very violent?
No. I mean, mental illness is not strongly associated with violence. Studies have shown that among the mentally ill, there's a slightly elevated risk of violence, maybe about twice as high as the regular population, but the occurrence of violence in the regular population is low.
My guest is Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's written a book called Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of Our Criminalized Mentally Ill. Getting back to Shane in Iowa, when did her mental illness first become apparent?
She was about 14 when she began to experiment with drugs, which is something that people with mental illness will do.
To self-medicate?
Yes, and that often is one reason why they are behind bars, because we have this ridiculous war on drugs in our society. But she was about 14 when she was deemed to be having an acute schizophrenic episode. She was acting bizarrely, laughing inappropriately. And the response then, and unfortunately the response for many years, was to sign her over to the state's care, because her family could not afford to pay for her hospitalization. So the state effectively took over care of Shane throughout the rest of her childhood and into early adulthood. She was in and out of mental institutions in Iowa about 25 times before she became involved in the criminal justice system, which, in her case and with her profile, was just an accident waiting to happen. And it's amazing it didn't happen sooner.
What did she do?
She became... she had a schizophrenic break. She broke down, and she jumped through a window, and the police were called. And when the town police chief arrived, a small town, she stabbed him in the chest.
Now, you said that she was smoking marijuana. Did that exacerbate her symptoms?
Yes. She had a very particular response to marijuana, and a very unfavorable one. It tended to exacerbate the symptoms of her schizophrenia, and she would have delusions, and she would think she was a Native American on a vision quest in the woods, and she would jump out of trees and do things that, some people with mental illness will do when they are having delusions.
It's ironic, isn't it, that drugs are the way we treat these people, but that often people who are on that medication refuse to take the psychotropic drugs that the doctors prescribe, and then take illegal ones that they can get elsewhere.
That's true. There's a whole class of legal drugs that we definitely push on people with mental illness, and we give them the imprimatur. We say it's good, it's okay for you to do this, and then there's this other class that they're not allowed to do and for which they may be put in prison or in jail. And in fact, in my Texas chapter about a 24-year-old man with bipolar disorder, who committed suicide in a jail. His major problem of a criminal justice nature was that he self-medicated, and he was arrested for having all of two pills of ecstasy, which amounted to a felony.
And he took ecstasy whenever he went into a depressed state because he was bipolar?
He took that and marijuana primarily because it made him feel better. And the legal drugs had terrible side effects.
So is part of the problem here also that many of the mentally ill are misdiagnosed before they wind up in the prisons?
It's not so much that they're misdiagnosed.
Well, if they have
drug issues.
But if you have somebody with drug issues and then you figure out that it's because of other problems, mm-hmm. then you have two choices. You punish them for the drug issues, or you address the problem that's leading to the drug issues.
Well, the mental illness was not an outgrowth of the drug issues in his case, and nor is it in many cases. It's a manifestation of mental illness, diagnosed and undiagnosed. So when he went to jail, he was having difficulty managing his mental illness and using illicit drugs.
So what happens in the prisons? Do they give them the psychotropic drugs?
Yes. And
is that the way that do the prisoners see that as a way of being controlled?
They will. Many of them will reject being medicated. Others will embrace it. It is a it's very common to receive psychotropic drugs in prisons, and it is in fact a form of control of inmates because their behavioral manifestations of illness can be mitigated.
But in many cases with things like bipolar situations, it's hard to find the right medication regimen, and sometimes you find one that works for a while and then doesn't work anymore. I suspect that the prisons aren't being that sophisticated about the treatments that they give these people.
Oh, exactly. They have formularies where they'll only give out-of-date drugs, or not the state-of-the-art drugs in prisons, and they certainly aren't as aggressive in changing medications when inmates don't respond.
Often, there's an if people are not in prison, there's a mix of drugs and therapy. They give in therapy in prisons?
No, not to any meaningful extent, and that's a big part of the problem, and a big reason why people with mental illness end up in solitary confinement units. The prisons in New York have about 8,400 people who are mentally ill or on the mental health caseload. That's about 13% of the population. And the whole numbers are double what they were in the early 90s. I mean, the system has really been overwhelmed.
Don't some prison systems actually have mental health wings?
Yes, they do.
Are they better?
They are. And what we need is more of these. Places where inmates who have mental illness can be removed from the general population and protected both from other inmates because they're often preyed upon, from themselves because they self-mutilate and they do things to hurt themselves or to get into trouble.
That's what Shane did. She mutilated herself in a way that I'm not going to ask you about because this is lunchtime and listeners can get rather upset by some of these stories.
Yes, yes. And Shane did those things while she was in solitary confinement for a period of 4 months. She was highly delusional, very ill, and she kept doing these things. She would be removed and given medical treatment and then put back into solitary confinement.
So the answer perhaps would have been to just keep on treating her on a medical level? Because I can see if I were, as you mentioned earlier, if I were a prison guard and somebody had these terrible outbursts and might start hitting other people and doing dangerous things, that I would try to isolate that person as much as possible.
Right, and that's what they would do in a mental hospital, too. If someone is extremely uncontrolled, they would put them into seclusion for a period of time. The problem is, in New York and in other states, we put these people who have mental illness into solitary confinement units for inordinately long periods of time. The average in New York State is 3 years. In Texas, it's 5 years. You talk to psychiatrists who have studied this issue, and they'll say that's unconscionable. That amounts to torture. And what happens is behavior deteriorates further. It certainly doesn't improve. It doesn't correct the situation it's meant to address.
My guest is Mary Beth Pfeiffer, who has been a longtime staff writer for the Poughkeepsie New York Journal. She's also written for the New York Times Magazine, The Village Voice, The Boston Globe, Miami Herald, The Hartford Courant, USA Weekend Magazine, The Des Moines Register. And she has written a book called Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of Our Criminalized Mentally Ill. It's published by Carol and Graff. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Mary Beth Pfeiffer, who's written a book called Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of Our Criminalized Mentally Ill. It's published by Carolyn Graff. We were talking about Iowa. Now, in the state of Iowa, isn't the number of psychiatric beds decreasing?
Well,
yes. Is that because there are fewer people mentally ill coming into the Iowa prison system?
Well, the prison system has very much taken the place of the mental health system in Iowa and across the country.
Because prisons. We emptied out many of our mental health facilities, and there are good arguments for doing that.
Exactly.
In most cases.
We had about 500,000 psychiatric hospital beds in the 50s. We're now down to about 87,000 or so. But what happened when we closed those beds was we were supposed to build a community care system to which those people could go and receive care. And that system just never materialized. But beyond that, we are still continuing to close psychiatric hospital beds long after deinstitutionalization we thought was over, and long after we recognized that we had all these gaps in the mental health system in the community. They still exist.
Is the funding, the decline in funding, limited to mental hospitals, or does it also affect outpatient clinics?
We do not have enough in terms of outpatient clinics. We have seen scant increases in funding for mental health care over the last decade. I think that the figure is something on the order of a 15% increase. But at the same time, we've had 100% increase, or 200% increase, rather, in funding for prisons. So where the beds exist is where the people go. Police officers will respond these days to someone in psychiatric crisis, and they'll know that if they take that person to an emergency room for something that could go either way in terms of a criminal nature or just some sort of acting out behavior, they know they're going to wait for hours. There's not going to be a certain outcome that person will be cared for. And so the path of least resistance leads right to the jail.
Are police officers, in, on the whole, being trained to recognize mental health problems?
It's happening, but very slowly. In my Florida chapter, I tell the stories of two men who were killed by police when they were in psychotic states and police were called ostensibly to help. And in each case, the police officers were not sufficiently trained. One man who was schizophrenic and whose family had filed papers to have him committed was shot by the police officer because he was attempting to publicly urinate. If the officer had better training, perhaps she could have de-escalated his aggressive, admittedly aggressive behavior. And in the other case, the man was suffocated when he was restrained by police officers who sat on him with him. He was face down with his hands cuffed and suffocated him. So the response has been by some police agencies, particularly in Florida, where a lot of these kinds of cases have occurred, is to train police officers better. And that's a good trend, but it's not happening to the extent that it needs to happen.
Have you looked at any of the health care plans that have been proposed by some of the candidates? Do any of them include dealing with this kind of problem?
Well, there are a couple of bills pending in Congress right now. I haven't looked particularly at the candidates and what they're saying, but it is a problem that needs to be approached from the national level. We have terrible health insurance for people with mental illness who have long been considered second-class citizens in terms of their access to health care. Physical ailments have taken priority over mental health ailments, and we need to have parity. So there are bills pending. Senator Kennedy has one in the Senate and his son in the House of Representatives to bring some measure of parity, because the outcome of not having appropriate insurance is that you don't have the appropriate care. We don't have enough psychiatrists in this country. We see beds closing, and that is a result of poor insurance.
And I understand also that there's a lot of personnel turnover in some of the mental health clinics, so there's no continuity. And also people aren't always as experienced as they should be. But you mentioned that we're losing hospital beds in mental health facilities, but of course we're getting more and more cells, prison cells. Is it because prisons are cheaper to build and maintain than mental health facilities?
Well, prisons are probably cheaper than inpatient hospitals, for sure. In New York, it costs about $32,000 a year to keep an inmate imprisoned. But to provide community care for someone with mental illness and keep them out of the criminal justice system would undoubtedly be cheaper. The idea is to provide preventive care and to stop people from getting to the point where they have a crisis and they go to a hospital, which is very expensive.
Now, the courts don't seem to be all that sympathetic in most cases. We hear of people who are obviously seriously mentally ill winding up not being adjudged as such either by juries or by judges. Is it because the laws are just really don't recognize these kinds of problems?
I think judges want a lot more choices in terms of dealing with people with mental illness. In my New York chapter, I talk about Jessica Roger. The judge tried very hard not to sentence her to prison. And he is one of many judges who have seen many more people with mental illness on their dockets. But after an exhaustive search of the alternatives, he ultimately concluded that he had no place else to send Jessica than a prison. And he knew that she was out of control, that she needed a place where she would be contained. And so he sentenced her to 3.5 years to 7 years in prison.
But as we see in this book, almost all of the people you profiled committed suicide. So are we sending these people to prison to not exactly certain death, but to a near certain death?
Well, not really. I mean, most
of
them.
Half of them committed suicide. That's a lot.
I chose, extreme examples. And suicide is an extreme example of what happens to someone who goes to prison who is mentally ill. The frequency of suicide in our prisons is not that great. It is probably about 10 to 15 suicides a year among a population of about 63,000.
You're talking about New York State.
That's right. So suicide is an extreme example, and most people who are mentally ill and most people who go to prison will eventually be released. 90% of people who go to prison are released to communities, and that's really the point. When they're released, we want them to be in better shape than when they went in, and we can be assured that they are not being released in better shape today.
Are there cases of people who didn't seem to have mental health problems who developed them as a result of being in prison?
That frequently happens as a result of being put into special housing units. They are meant to be psychologically stressful environments. They're meant to be places where inmates do not want to go, and they're supposed to deter infractions inside of prisons. And the fact that we sentence people there for long periods of time often leads people who don't have prior histories to becoming ill in them.
My guest is Mary Beth Pfeiffer. Her book, Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of Our Criminalized Mentally Ill, is published by Carol and Graff. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, we have the added problem of sometimes recognizing that a person is disturbed, but not being able to do anything about it. I'm thinking about the Virginia Tech shootings. Cho Seung-hui, pretty much everybody recognized that he had tendencies toward violence. But nothing could be done until it was too late.
Well, I've looked at that case, and he was actually ordered by a judge into an assisted outpatient treatment program. And his case really illustrates the holes in our mental health system. The National Alliance for Mental Illness did an analysis state by state of mental health care and gave the entire nation a D. And Virginia was one of the states that also got a D. And what happened was, after he was ordered to get this treatment of an outpatient nature, no one ever followed up. Now, what should have happened in a better system is there should have been an aggressive intervention by the mental health center that was assigned his case to find out where he was. And if he didn't report for treatment, someone should have gone out and found out why he wasn't reporting, and the judge should have become involved and did something, perhaps put him in an inpatient unit.
Now, many people have been aware of this as a growing problem. So have there been any enlightened proposals? Are there any states that have instituted programs that you think are positive steps?
There are positive steps going on. There's the crisis intervention training for police that I referred to, and many more agencies are adopting that. There's something in Florida called forensic assertive community treatment, in which teams of people are assigned to people with mental illness who live in the community. One caseworker will have just 10 people, which is a very small caseload, and they'll visit the person at home, and they'll make sure they have their medications and that they're taking their medications, and that perhaps if there's a day treatment program, they're plugged into that. The program has had very limited success, however. A great number of people are still being hospitalized. In the first year of its operation, there were 40 deaths among this population of 3,000 people, which is a lot. And the problem seems to be that there just is not the infrastructure into which we can plug these people. And instead, they are continuing to deteriorate.
And you're suggesting it's because we're being penny wise and pound foolish?
I would certainly suggest that we are penny wise and pound foolish. And among the biggest lapses in care for people with mental illness is housing. In New York, we have a big homeless problem still. It's not so visible anymore because we have shelters. But we have 35,000 New Yorkers in homeless shelters, which increased last year by 11%. So the problem's not going away. And if people don't have decent places to live, that certainly is one of the most stabilizing forces of their life.
On the other hand, whenever facilities are built for people who have mental problems, the people in the area complain, not in my neighborhood, becomes a big issue because reasonably they're afraid for their safety and the safety of their children.
Yes, and a lot of education needs to occur so that people recognize that people with mental illness are our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters. Mental illness is common, relatively. We all know someone who has been or is mentally ill. So we need education, and we need to renew the efforts to put those facilities in the community. Once resistance cropped up in the 90s and in the 80s, I can remember group homes that were proposed and never put up. We just have to keep trying.
Is New York one of the better states, or are we also a D?
No, actually, New York was unrated because it was only one of two states that failed to respond to the survey. It was called unresponsive. But there were some criticisms of our resources here. New York spends a lot of money on mental health care. We are actually third per capita in the country. You'd think we'd be doing better, but if we are spending that much money and still having this homeless problem and this prison problem, there's something wrong.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer, her book, Crazy in America, The Hidden Tragedy of Our Criminalized Mentally Ill. It's published by Carolyn Graff. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.